I was just wondering about how racing runs in families, particularly training, breeding, riding racehorses. Sorry, hello, Cornelius here, Cornelius Lysett with the Cornelius Cast. Yeah, I was just wondering if the concept of the dynasty in racing, quite a usual thing, was mirrored in other sports, other walks of life in racing. The O'Briens seem to be establishing quickly in Ireland, Aidan, Joseph, Donica. There's also in Ireland the Carbery Moore family, the extended Carbery Moore family, and others. In the UK, the Baldings, current trainer Andrew, the Easterbys, current trainer Tim, the Hillses, current trainer Charlie, and the Johnson Hortons, current trainer Eve, who is, I'm very pleased to say, my guest on the Cornelius Cast this week. You're a bit of a dynasty, aren't you, the Johnson Hortons? What generation are you, trainer-wise?
I'm third generation, but there have been more trainers before. Yes, third generation, but both sets of grandparents trained. So I don't know. So I'm third generation both sides, probably, I suppose.
So if people in this sport always look at pedigrees, they wouldn't have been surprised that that you ended up doing the same kind of thing.
Yeah, probably not. I was fairly surprised, but maybe not on pedigree.
And you're talking to us from Woodway Stables at Blueberry near Didcot. How many generations have trained, of your family have trained there?
Three generations have trained here. So my grandparents bought it after the war. My grandfather trained and then he was sadly killed. And then my grandmother trained here when women weren't allowed licenses. So several other people held the license, but she trained. And then my father and now me.
And your father trained for 45 years or something, didn't he?
For a very
long time.
Yeah.
We'll come on to your granny, Helen, in just a second. But then just paint us a bit of a family tree, because you said on both sides you had trainers.
So my mother's father, John Goldsmith, he trained in Aston Tyrrell. So that's literally 2 miles away from where we are now, and used the gallops here as well. He trained jumpers.
So the pedigree really has got, it does run in the family, doesn't it?
Yeah, it would appear so. Either that or we just don't know what else to do with ourselves.
Well, I'm sure that's not the case. Though you used to do other things. You weren't always a trainer. You were in London once upon a time. You weren't presumably training racehorses down around Trafalgar Square.
No. I was. I worked for a market research company, actually. I was sort of just office bound then. I really enjoyed it. But I wasn't really a London bird. I'm better in the country, I think.
What were you researching? What markets were you researching?
Anything. It was a qualitative market research company, very boutique company. There were only 6 people who worked there. It was very interesting to learn about marketing and advertising and what worked and what didn't. It was very interesting.
And then you've been training, I think, since 2007 when you took over from your dad. But it's your grandmother who really interests me even more than everyone else, because literally she was training racehorses. But nobody would recognise that women could hold a licence. It seems, in 2020, seems extraordinary.
I know, you wouldn't believe it, but women were not allowed to hold licences. In fact, some years ago, we were clearing out the office and we found some extraordinary letters between the jockey club and my grandmother when my father was going to take over the licence, I think, aged 20. And they were very keen for him not to, because they said that all he was going to be the face of her. And we certainly couldn't have a female in charge of such a business.
Which was true, wasn't it? Because certainly initially, because she'd had Peter Warwin, who's a cousin, had been one of the assistants. And there were a couple of others as well.
Yes, a couple of head lads had done it as well. So they were, absolutely, it was true. But I mean, it was quite shocking that they could not envisage a woman possibly being able to be in charge and knowing what to do.
And that continued until 1966, I think.
Yeah.
When Florence Nagel took the jockey club to the High Court, but I think she'd failed a couple of times because the jockey club got hold of their mates in the High Court and said, send her away. So it wasn't until 1966. So if we were in 1966 rather than now, you couldn't be training. That is an extraordinary thought.
And it's not that long ago, really. And then I know Granny thought that she'd take the licence over, but my father wasn't that keen on that. He said he'd started to establish himself. Thank you very much. He would keep the licence. So
he'd got the feet under the table.
He'd got his feet under the table, exactly. But, you know, my grandmother, she lived till she was 102. She was an extraordinary woman. And she certainly had a huge influence on the training and Dad and me.
And so when she had these assistants, Peter Warwin, there was a guy called Charles, what was his surname? Jerdin?
Jerdin, I think it was,
and
yeah.
Dick Poole, was he part? Yeah. Was he an assistant as well? Yeah. Who has a race named after him somewhere, doesn't he? Salisbury, I think. So she ran the show, did she? But when the race card appeared or the newspaper appeared, it said one of their names.
I believe so. I mean, obviously, I wasn't around in that time, but that's what I understand.
And so at a time when, let's be honest, that females in whatever walk of life were probably not as rated as highly as they should, did she sort of realise at the time, did everyone realise at the time what a sort of strange situation it was, or did everyone just accept it, do you think?
I don't think she was that chuffed, but I think she did accept it. But it's really hard from us in this perspective, where we are now, to look back and see how different life was then. It's different times and people thought differently. And I don't know how Granny felt, to be honest. I really don't. I mean, I know she'd have liked to have trained, but I don't know how she felt, whether she felt she was cheated out of it or what. I don't know.
So I suppose in 2020 we're a bit more right on, aren't we? We're a bit more sort of socially liberal. So we recoil in shock at that kind of piece of history.
Yeah, but it is history. I mean, different times. There's, you know, everything evolves, obviously, and of course women should have equal rights and do everything probably better than most men, I think. But in those days they just didn't believe they were capable, and they had to prove themselves again and again and again.
And she won. She won the 2,000 guineas, did she?
Yes, she won the 2,000 guineas with Gilles de Retz, who was owned by Mr. Samuel, and his daughter, Jackie O'Halloran, has horses with me still. So that's really nice.
Oh, so it runs in that family as well?
Yeah, yeah.
Was she allowed to be in the winner's enclosure? Was she, or did she have to really take, do you think, a
Oh, no, no, I think she was in the winner's enclosure. I've seen pictures of her in the winner's enclosure.
So everyone knew, did they?
But yeah, it was an open secret.
Yeah, so which just adds to the bizarre nature of the whole story, really.
Mm.
And then I think her last assistant was Peter Warwin, was it? Or before your dad came back. And I read he was summoned from, was he working in Australia or something like that? He was summoned back.
Yeah, he'd gone over to Australia and he's working out there, and he was summoned back to come and take the licence.
And he, in all those decades of training, horses like Habitat, Ile de Bourbon, Ribeiro, Ribocco, they were some of the bigger names of. He had some of the biggest names around, didn't he, at the time?
Yeah, he was. He had some lovely horses. He was champion trainer in Ireland for 2 years because he won the Irish Derby 2 years in succession with Ribocco and Ribeiro, and he had some beautiful horses. And you know, not forgetting champion filly Rose Bowl, she was amazing. Double Form was champion sprinter. You know, he had some fantastic horses.
And you grew up around them, these horses?
Yes. I mean, I remember Ile de Bourbon. I remember Double Form. I remember Rose Bowl. I don't remember much further back than that.
And so you'd have gone to some big days, would you? Racing some big days and cheered on some big winners?
I went to King George when Ile de Bourbon won. That was probably the biggest one. I was about 7, I think. Something like that, quite young, yeah. So, yes, went to a few big days.
And obviously got used to the big... Everyone got pretty used to the big days. So when numbers dwindled a bit, it was all the more surprising.
Well, you know, a lot of things sort of happened. It was the perfect storm, really. Unfortunately, Charlie Engelhard died.
Big owner.
You know, he had quite a few horses. The Aga Khan stopped having horses in England, so that was quite a lot. And Dolly Rothschild also passed away, and so we, you know, she went down from having 15 or 16 horses, and the family went down to having 2 or 3 with Dad. So I mean, it was like the perfect storm of having 80 horses down to about 40 or 30 all in within about 2 years.
But I see in Horses in Training 2020, you're back up at the sort of numbers, because how many would there have been? I seem to remember sort of 20 odd when you started.
Yeah, I think I started with about 20. Last year we had about 75, 80, and this year we're about, you know, we've had a few drop out, there's no doubt about it. So we're down to about sort of 65, 70 now.
So you'd given up your market research. I think you did a bit of time managing syndicates for Henry Ponsonby, who's still an owner of yours.
Yep.
then you start training. And so you've got so this business that's got all this history and heritage, these lovely stables, all these acres and acres of gallops. You've got to start building it back up again. So you had a task on your hands when you started again.
I did, but you know, God, I started from a nice base. It's better than starting from scratch. And it's, as you say, it's the most beautiful place to train. I love it here. We've got 200 acres of grass gallops. We've got an all-weather. And we've just been upgrading, trying to upgrade everything all the time, just slightly bringing it into the modern era, as they say. So put in a spa and all sorts of things like that. So we're just everything, every year we just try and upgrade it a little bit.
200 acres, and that's yours, is it? You can just get on and do what you want?
Oh, yeah, don't share.
And I was going to talk about your maternal grandfather, but let's just put him on hold for a second. I've been out on the gallops with you there, and I'm really fascinated by how you just look at a horse and you just know. What do you see when you see these horses coming up? Because for most people, these horses canter up and it all looks beautiful and there's lovely 200 acres, bloody blah, bloody blah, blah, blah. But it's so clear that you see even more when you look at those horses.
I hope so. I mean, sometimes they're head scratches, as you know. You know, they don't quite do what you expect them to do. But you try and just, you know, you see them every day and you get to know them every day. And you know your staff really well. I'm lucky I've got some great staff. Most of them have been with me a long time. So I know what they can tell me what they're feeling. And because of my experience of having had those staff for so long, I know what they mean. And it's, you know, I'm lucky it works like that.
So what might a horse go from looking like from being looking well to not looking so well? So what are the sort of telltale signs you think you look for?
Well, their coats might go a bit dull. They'll lose a bit of weight. They're not going up the gallops with their normal demeanour. I mean, some horses barely get out of a canter anyway. You know, that's them. And if they suddenly start pulling, then there's something wrong because there's something hurting. Or if there's a horse that bounds up the gallop every day, and then suddenly they're just lolloping up, there's probably something wrong with them. It's just the change in their demeanour, and possibly, you know, their eyes don't look so bright, their coat might not look so great. You just, you know, you get to know their mannerisms and their characteristics. They're like children, really. You know, it's like having the teacher know if their child's not right or something.
So if a child screams in the front row most days and then goes quiet, it's the same sort of difference.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And do you sometimes have the other way around, a horse that hasn't quite been pleasing you, suddenly you think, wow? Do you have sort of wow moments as they suddenly come into themselves?
Yes, you suddenly think, oh, that's works okay, that works okay. And then suddenly the penny drops and they suddenly do a really good bit of work. You think, oh, where's that one been hiding his little light under a bushel? And then again, you know, you have horses that work really well at home and they get to the track and they're just going, no. Can't be bothered. And those are the most frustrating things.
And you mentioned a spa. What? Just paint us a picture of an equine spa.
So an equine spa, they walk in, a bit like walking into the stalls, but it's an all-enclosed thing. And it fills up with cold water with Epsom salts in. And you turn on this bubbling machine. It bubbles up all around. So it's like they have a sort of cold water. It's like going in the sea, but we're not near the sea. My ideal place would be if I could just walk into the sea every day. And it's great for cooling down their legs and their joints and their knees. And, you know, they love it. And you put them in there for about 10, 15 minutes and they come out and it just really helps keep everything tight. And, you know, it's a sort of remedial thing.
And does it have to be Epsom salts or could it be any old salt?
Epsom salts seem to be the thing that works. I don't know. They obviously have extra sulfur. I don't ask me chemical questions because I'm not gifted in that department.
But it works.
But it works, yeah.
And does everyone love it? Do all horses love it? Or do some of them see the bubbles and want to run a mile?
You get the odd one that is a conscientious objector, but most of them love it, yeah.
And what is your best known horse, Accidental Agent? Is he like a sesh in the spa?
He loves a session in the spa, but we have a secret inkling that maybe he liked the session in the spa so much, that's why he didn't jump out the stalls at Ascot last year, because he was just used to standing in the spa, just going, oh, that's lovely, thank you very much, and then waddling out. I don't know, but he's not been allowed back in since.
So you said that the spa is a bit like going into the stall, so is it that kind of shape, that kind of size?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a really, but that I find that fascinating that you have got to. So let's just remind ourselves. So accidental agent, Royal Ascot, 2019, defending his title in the Queen Anne Stakes, and a lot of build up, a lot of hype, media banging on the door of Woodway Stables. We want to talk and take photos, and then he didn't jump out of the stalls. And so how big a head scratcher was that? I find it fascinating that it might be down to the spa.
Well, who knows? Or something hurt him. You know, something was hurting him that day, or something distracted him. I mean, who knows? Trying to get into a horse's head is just a nightmare. But touch wood, he's been pretty good since. I've no idea. No idea what happened. It's just so frustrating because that race was sort of set up for him and he just didn't partake. But there we go. That's horses for you. That is the most wonderful but frustrating thing about the little darlings.
The little darlings. So 12 months after he'd given you your greatest moment by winning the Queen Anne, was that one of your worst moments when he wouldn't come out of the stalls?
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely, because you just feel a fool and a fraud and you just think, oh, well, how do we sort that one out then?
So did you go and do you, and I've seen trainers who do this, go into the boxes and stand and look at them and chat and just try and get a clue?
Well, I mean, I had a chat with him and he just looked at me and went, another bit of grass, please. Thank you very much. but I got Gary Whitford, who's very good in the stalls. He's come in and we just jumped him out at home. And you'll notice he goes in last all the time now, because I think if he stands in there too long, he might do it again.
And so Gary Whitherford is this sort of wizard character who can persuade horses to go into the stalls. Accidental Agent, then, is named after your maternal grandfather, John Goldsmith, who you mentioned, who trained a few jumpers at Aston Tyrold, as you said. But he was also pretty extraordinary. I'm surprised maybe someone has made a film about him. He was a member of Winston Churchill's SOE, Special Operations Executive, during the war. Had to escape from Nazis and things like that.
Yes, he was. He wrote an autobiography, which was called Accidental Agent. And then there was another book written based on the autobiography called Blown. But as far as I know, there's been no film made about him. But he was an extraordinary man. He was brilliant and brave. And he won the Croix de Guerre and quite decorated. Is it the DMSO? Is that another medal?
Sounds right.
So I'm not very good about this. Again, I'm not very clever. But he's... He was an extraordinary man, yeah.
How did he go from being training a few racehorses and being your mother's father to escaping the Gestapo?
Well, he was brought up in France, so he spoke fluent French. He had flat feet or a bad back or something, so he couldn't go into the army. And then I don't know whether he was volunteered or he volunteered for the SOE, because he could speak fluent French and he was of the right age, but he couldn't be in the army.
And I love the story that you tell about your mother meeting someone at a party who said, oh, your father's, there was a book written by your father called Accidental Agent, I might call a horse that. And your mother sort of decided that wasn't a good idea. She wanted the name.
Yeah, she took against that somewhat. So, yeah, that's why we got the name.
And did you, was he bought or was he bred or how did he?
He's a homebred. Out of my mother's got the wonderful family that we sort of fell into. This he was the first foal of the mare, and he didn't get a bid at the sales. In fact, no one even looked at him.
Didn't even look at him.
He was by Delicator, who wasn't fashionable. First foal, and it was sort of the market had crashed a bit about that time. Literally, book three.
So this is Tattersall's in Newmarket.
Yeah, and yeah. I think we bought him back for £8,000 or £10,000, something like that.
And so when, with his backstory, his name, you bred him, your mum owned him, you trained him, when he won the Queen Anne, I remember seeing you. You were kissing everybody and jumping up and down and clearly in joyous form.
Every year my aim is to have an Ascot winner and to have a group winner. Well, I'd only ever achieved one group winner, and I never achieved an Ascot winner. So the first day of the first race, to win a group one at Royal Ascot with my mother's horse was unbelievable. It was extraordinary. And I sort of fancied him going in there, you know, he'd finished sixth in the lockage, and I thought, you know, if he runs really well, we should run into a place. And I couldn't believe it, to be honest. It was goosebump stuff and fairy tale stuff, and you know, ridden by Charlie, who wouldn't be the most fashionable jockey,
Charlie Bishop.
And it was just amazing. It was absolutely wonderful, and it was the best day of my racing career by far. And I will be amazed if it ever gets topped. I can still, even talking about it now, I get goosebumps and think about it.
And do you remember the outpouring of joy on your behalf? People were really, really chuffed for you, weren't they? And Charlie Bishop and your family and the horse himself.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. I'll never forget it. I'll just never forget. And you're going back to the old trainer's car park and everyone was going mad. It was fantastic. And then on the Tuesday night of Ascot, I always have friends staying. And I came back here and they were just, you know, we had more parties and everyone was just, it was extraordinary. And all the staff came in and they had champagne flowing. It was just amazing. It was a time out of time day.
And then for what happened 12 months later, that must have felt like someone was paying you back for the...
Do you know something? I'd take it every time. To have that first day, I'd take it every time.
Yeah. And did you, in terms of... that having had all that fun the previous year, when things went wrong the following year, did you shrug your shoulders or did you get in the car and go home? Or how did you cope with what was a real reversal?
I went and licked my wounds in a bar with a large bottle of wine with some friends, and then I was fine. Because you have to be fine. You have to look at your other horses and the next day and the next day and get on with it. These things happen. They are horses. They're not machines, and they are sent to confound us.
And it feels like that. You said sent to confound us. You do say that with real, you know, with the experience of an experienced horse person. You say that.
It is never ending. There's always a wheel that falls off somewhere, especially, you know, they're horses.
And you've got 80 now, so something, presumably, there's never a dull moment.
No, you have a vet in the yard most of the time.
Really? So, and what happens when something goes, you've got a horse primed for such and such, and something goes wrong a day or two before or a week before or whatever, do you just have to draw on your reserves of philosophy?
Eventually.
Right.
I wouldn't say that's immediate.
So eventually, so your instant reaction.
There's a few expletives that happen before that.
That has been known, has it?
That has been known, but we get there eventually.
And you've talked about the fact that that your grandmother couldn't train and other people had to be the front person. So what about for you? People talk about females in sport all the time. It's, you know, I used to work for the BBC until recently. You know, we were talking about it all the time. Do you find that sort of chat tedious, or does it get your blood boiling or make you more determined? How do you deal with all that?
It's a bit of everything. I mean, I think... I'm really lucky. I had a leg up. I took over my father. There's no doubt about it. That helped. And it is definitely, difficult for women in racing. There aren't enough women trainers. There aren't enough women jockeys. There aren't enough women bloodstock agents. And I don't know why. And it is frustrating. And then people say, well, I don't know why. Oh, but then they don't send their horses to women trainers. Why don't you? They don't let women ride their horses. Why don't you? And I know you should go for the best available of most people, the people you enjoy spending time with or whatever, but you know, to actively make a difference, you have to actively make a difference.
So you say things are still in 2020 difficult for women in racing, do you think?
Definitely. I think so. It's definitely harder.
And can you actually just define that in terms of how you give an example of that?
No, not really. I don't, well, the big spending owners wouldn't have horses with female trainers at this. I can't think of one female trainer that has big spending owners in their yard. Jessica Harrington, but barring Jessica Harrington, sorry.
In Ireland.
But in England, I can't think of any female trainer that has a big spending owner with them.
So do you think big spending owners have looked at you and said, oh, that's a female trainer, so I'm going to look elsewhere?
No, I don't think that at all.
Right.
I don't think they think.
Right.
I don't think it occurs to them. I don't think they go, well, I'm not having it with a woman trainer. I'm absolutely convinced it. But I think it's who you know. It's the old school tie sort of thing where you go, you know, it's very unconscious in my opinion. I don't think anyone actively says, well, I'm not having it with a woman, she can't do the job. Of course they don't. I don't think they actively believe that either. But to really promote women, you need to get, they need to be getting the better horses or getting on the better horses if they're jockeys. You know, look at Holly Doyle. She is brilliant. She's doing amazingly well. Mm. Did she get a ride in the Derby? No.
Yeah, I saw somebody said she, you know, she rode the, did she ride four winners in one night at Wolverhampton just before the Derby? Mm. And somebody observed, not good enough to get a ride in the Derby. My reaction to that was, on the one hand, fair point, but on the other hand, well, what would she have ridden? You know, there was...
Well, what would she have ridden? And also, would she have wanted to ride an also-ran?
Yeah.
Probably not, you know. But, you know, she doesn't get a huge amount of rides in group races. She doesn't.
Hmm. Though, obviously, Josie Gordon was champion apprentice. Hayley Turner was champion apprentice a long time ago. You employ an apprentice for quite a lot of rides, Georgia.
Yep, Georgia Derby. But she doesn't get many outside rides, and I think she's really good. You know, she rides really well. Doesn't get many outside rides. And I don't know why not. I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily to do with being a woman. I don't know. Maybe I'm not promoting her enough. I don't know.
Do you employ her? Does it give you extra satisfaction to employ her because she's a woman?
Not really.
Right.
I'd like to employ the best, and she's a good girl. She rides really, really well, I think.
And just, we're coming towards the end of this chat. Looking ahead, I just something struck me of from what you said earlier on. You said people are dropping out. I think you're talking about owners and obviously the current climate. The COVID, the economy, etc., etc. You are detecting, are you, one or two signs of people having to abandon maybe racehorse ownership as a luxury?
I think it's worrying times for all business in any walk of life, and you know, racing is a luxury item, and it'll be interesting. We'll come to sales, see where we are with it. I hope it's not going to get hit too badly, but I think, you know, the prize money is. Got hit so badly, it's really hard to convince people that to come and, you know, yes, it's fun, but you actually need to, if you win a race, get some money back. And it's really hard when our prize money is appalling. And I'm not blaming anyone for that. That is the nature of the beast, having coming from COVID.
Have you actually seen signs of people dropping out or suggesting they might drop out?
Yeah, you know, when horses aren't very good, or, you know, they might have kept going a bit longer. And no, let's get rid. And whether they will replace, it'll be interesting. I don't know.
And are you gearing up your business as, you know, your business is obviously different to running a cinema or a pub or an engineering company or whatever. But are you gearing yourself up for the future when things might not be so good?
They're horses. They need feeding. It's a very labour intensive. What do you do? You know, you do your best and hope it's good enough.
Well, look. Thank you, Eve. I hope it's good enough. I'm sure it will be good enough. I did love hearing about your family dripping in racing heritage, in espionage heritage, in equality heritage as well. Thanks very much indeed for being with me on the Cornelius Cast. Thank you to you for listening, and please do consider subscribing so you'll never miss an episode. We'll chat again soon on the Cornelius Cast.